The views and opinions expressed by the guests on the following program do not necessarily represent those of Mark Radio, The Shepherd, or its advertisers.
From the studios of the Shepherd Radio Network, it's Afternoons with Mike. This next hour is all about our walk with Jesus, with local pastors, newsmakers, people who are making a difference for the gospel. Now, here is your host, Mike Gilland.
Welcome to the last program of the year for Afternoons with Mike here on The Shepherd. Hard to believe that 2021 has come to an end, but indeed it has, or almost anyway. And we celebrate the big new year tomorrow. We pray that it is going to be a safe one and a fun one for you and your family. I have in the studio with me today, I do believe that my first interview ever with a judge is today. So this is very exciting. Judge Vince Chu. He is right now kind of finishing up a term as a family court judge and is about to transition to becoming a civil judge. And so that's going to be exciting to hear that story. Judge Vince Chu, welcome to my program.
Thank you for having me.
It's really great to have you. As of yesterday, by the way, I made a big milestone, 500 interviews. So you're number 501. That's done. So that's pretty exciting. I'm starting a new chapter of all that today.
Well, I hope I'm the first of 500 more. So.
That's me too. I hope the same. This is really wonderful. Now, you came to actually your parents, let me say it correctly. Your parents came to America as political refugees. You were born in the United States, but not too terribly long before that, they were refugees to the U.S. Tell us that story.
So my dad was grew up in Burma, which is now officially known as Myanmar, and my mom, her story's a little more winding.
Mm-hmm.
She was part of the old Chinese aristocracy, her grandfather was actually a governor of one of the provinces in China, and when the communists took over. After World War II, her family fled China, but my mom was just a baby, so they left her with an adopted family in Hong Kong, which was, British territory at that point. And my mom and my dad met in Hong Kong, after that, they came over to the United States. In refugee status, and actually met up with my mom's birth family who had come here some years prior to that.
Mm-hmm. So when you say aristocracy, you're talking about they were reigning officials then in the area, not too different than being what we would understand as a governor or what.
Right. Yeah. My great grandfather was the equivalent of the governor of Guangzhou.
Mm-hmm. And so that's pretty high ranking, and yet all of that changed, right, when the communists came in.
Oh, yeah. So when my mom's family came over, they came over with not much, actually.
Mm-hmm.
They started over and, set up in a little row house in Chinatown in Philadelphia, and that's the my grandparents' home as I knew it when mm-hmm. I was a kid. So.
Now, for those that would not be that familiar, I've only been through that area of Philly one time. Tell us about what it was like growing up there.
Well, so I mean, I grew up in the New Jersey suburbs, which I mean, frankly, is not that not that different than probably what a lot of people are used
okay.
to. I visit my grandparents in Chinatown, which was, it was a different experience. It was this little Chinese enclave in, in the middle of a major metropolitan city, which to me was very normal, but mm-hmm. I guess to other people would be a little different.
Well, just the pocket, it's really amazing. Like you said, it is an enclave. It's a pocket, and when you're in the middle of that, it feels very much like, I would say, very similar to what it would be like if you were there in China.
sort of.
Yeah, with range, obviously.
Right. I mean, you know, everybody still speaks English, and it, so it's a much easier transition. Mm-hmm. But it's still very different than probably most people are used to.
Now, your dad ended up opening up a Chinese restaurant. Was that something that he had done in the restaurant business, or was that in the family before moving here?
No. My dad was actually, in manufacturing and when he was in Hong Kong. But when you come over into the United States, without a lot of contacts, without a lot of connections, and I think for a lot of people, opening up a restaurant was kind of the way forward.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what my dad did. Actually, in retrospect, I realized that he never really particularly liked the restaurant business. He never really liked customer service. He just did it all those years to, mm-hmm. In the hopes that, me and my siblings would be able to, pursue things that, that fit us better.
Right. And he's living out truly the American dream of somebody coming over and working and saving and hoping to better themselves. And that's exactly what he did. Even though, like you said, he didn't really enjoy the process or the business side of what he did all that much, but he did it to care for your family.
No, absolutely. I mean, my dad worked 6 days a week, 10 hours a day. Just about to the day he died.
Mm-hmm.
And, with the idea with the hope and which was realized that me and my brother and my sister would, get to not do that. So he passed away last year or this past year in mm-hmm. February, which was, and it was sudden and it was, heartbreaking, but
very, very young.
Yeah. He was 66.
Yeah.
But, what I'm really thankful for and was a huge blessing is that, so the last time I saw my dad, it was before the pandemic. The last time I saw my dad was my investiture, which is this, ceremony mm-hmm. for judges taking the bench. And it was in December of 2019. I started talking about my dad's and my mom's journey at the beginning of my remarks. And I looked over and my dad is weeping.
Oh my goodness.
And, if you knew my dad, he was someone that, I mean, he was a very kind person, but he was also a very stoic person. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've seen my dad cry like maybe twice in my life. And he was weeping. And, I think to some degree it was because he was proud, of my, sort of path in life.
Yeah. Well, that's quite an achievement.
But I also think to some degree it made him realize when he looked around the room and saw, all of these judges and local officials there to celebrate mm-hmm. his son, that I think for him, he realized that it made him feel like he was no longer a foreigner living in the United
right.
States.
Yeah. He
but
was
in fact. He too was American.
Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful thing. And I'm so glad you have that he was able to be there. And it really is shocking. Anyone that's lost their dad, their mom, it's a tough thing. It's doubly tough when they're that age and it's unexpected and sudden. But it was a heart attack, you said, that claimed his life then.
It was. And, my dad was healthy, mm-hmm. Never smoked, never drank, kept fit. I think it was just his time.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Lord has that time for us all. And I'm really grateful that you were able to share that experience with him being there and watching you. And it was Governor DeSantis that appointed you into this role. And you've served there for just over 2 years now then, right?
Yes.
And so now tell us a little bit about how you came to know the Lord. This is another part of your story that I know nothing about?
So, my parents weren't Christians, and I mean, I don't know that they were really. They were maybe agnostic, to say the least, and you know, there were some cultural aspects of mm-hmm. where they come from that they practiced, but I growing up, I was drawn to youth group, you know, through some friends of mine, and early in junior high. Initially, I was drawn to the church because I felt accepted and mm-hmm. I felt welcomed. And, you know, I think to this day, I feel like that's one of the things where the church is at its best, is that, you know, we sort of welcome the misfits and the people that don't necessarily, you know, maybe feel like outsiders.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what initially drew me to.
What church was this?
Youth group. It was called Bethel Baptist Church in mm-hmm. in New Jersey, and I would start going to the youth group, not really for the message. You know, I sat through the message, but it was just, you know, because I really enjoyed the fellowship. I think, but. Over time, as I went, you know, the message sunk in, because, you know, that I think all of us, that's, you know, there's a piece of us that's calling out for the gospel, and I think that's what happened for me. And you know, the story is probably not terribly dramatic. It's probably like a lot of you hear. I was at, you know, junior high Bible camp, and you know, there was the invitation, and I took my stick and threw it in the fire, and accepted the Lord, you know, that night. But I think it was a long process after that for me to sort of grow in that. You know, I think a lot of times we emphasize that moment of salvation, and I think that's a pivotal point. But I don't know that's really, I don't know that, and I don't know that everybody has that one moment. You know, I feel like I can pinpoint it, but mm-hmm. you know, I think for some people it was a process.
No, you're right. It's surprisingly, I would say at least 30-40% of the people I've talked to really don't know or remember the exact moment when that happened in their lives, but it's nonetheless real. And it's almost like some people have described it. They feel like I've always known the Lord. I can't remember not knowing. But others, like you said, there are those single moments. And I remember the night, that would be true for me. I remember the night when I gave my heart to the Lord. I was 10 years old, and my life changed. And so yours did as well. And it's really great that it happened in a group of people like that, that were so inviting, is what obviously you experienced.
Yeah. And, you know, and I kept going to that youth group throughout high school. You know, my closest friends were really there. I went to, Rutgers, which is the state university in New Jersey, for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
I transferred to Cedarville, which is a Christian college in the middle of nowhere, in Ohio. But I craved that. I craved, you know, having some Bible instruction, being with other Christians who could sharpen me, and that, you know, then I could pour into, you know, for a time in my life. I mean, I don't know that it's, for me, it would have been healthy to stay in that bubble forever, but for 2 years to kind of be in this environment where I could grow and learn, you know, was really pivotal for my faith walk as well.
It really is in all of our walk. I mean, that whole thing of becoming a disciple, and you mentioned it being in a bubble, and I would just like to say you were being nurtured, and that's really was a critical time. And, you know, you had to get prepared to go out on your own, which is what you did, moving to college. Now, that's a big deal when you move away, and now you're in the middle, like you said, in the middle of nowhere. I'm not familiar with Cedarville. Is that in the center of the state?
Well, I don't know that it's in the center necessarily, but it's It's certainly in the middle of nowhere. I mean, it's near Dayton.
Okay.
Near Springfield. It's out there.
Wow. So how early on did you have any idea that you were interested in law? Was that while you were in high school or before?
Well, you know, for anybody who's grown up with Asian parents, there's a stereotype that you're allowed to be a doctor, an engineer, and if neither of those work out, maybe a lawyer. So I think there was always in the back of my head that I don't want to be a doctor or an engineer. But, you know, I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do. Incidentally, after I graduated college, I went on a missions trip to South Africa.
Oh.
On a 6-week missions trip. And on one of the nights of that missions trip, there was a call. So what it was is that, I was a worship leader, play guitar and sing.
That's awesome.
And one of the things my job was to train worship leaders, in sort of how to use modern worship, drum sets, electric guitars, all that stuff. And they were looking for someone to continue doing that and to start a Christian radio station, incidentally, like alternative rock Christian radio, mm-hmm. kind of thing in South Africa. So, and I felt the call and I was like, you know, I'm going to do this. I'm going to be a missionary. I'm going to go home and I'll raise support. And I'm going to come back here and I'm going to sign up. I'm going to pray about it. And I've seen this before where when you pray about whether you should be a missionary, it's like a foregone conclusion, right? So I was like, I'm going to pray about it. I'm going to sleep on it. And, tomorrow I'm going to sign on the dotted line. I woke up, the first thing that hit my email box was an email message from the Ohio State University School of Law. And it said that, because I had applied to some law schools, just because, frankly, I didn't know what I was going to do. And the email said that someone had just donated $30 million to the law school, and they wanted to offer me a full ride to law school with a stipend, but they needed to know, they needed an answer by like the end of the week or something like that.
My goodness.
So I took that.
That was, you know, your answer.
I joke that I took that as a rejection letter from God. but I think in actuality it was simply it was God guiding me onto another path that was probably, and in retrospect, I was probably better suited for.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a really beautiful story to realize that your heart was open to be a missionary. And thank God for people who have that call, not only in their own heart, like you did, but from God, where that is His plan. And obviously for you, it's worked out beautifully that you did this thing of going to Ohio State. Now, our friends in Gainesville would say, okay, let's talk about that one for a moment. But no, seriously, I'm so grateful that you had that opportunity. And what a blessing from God to get a free ride, a full ride. That's incredible.
Yeah, and actually, it was because of that. That's what drew me into public service.
Mm.
Because I took that as a mandate for me. You know, I'm not paying for law school, and I'm coming out of law school with very little debt, at mm-hmm. least in comparison to most people.
Oh, yeah.
So I, you know, I took that sort of as, for me, I was like, I'm going to go into public service because I don't have to pay off all this debt.
Well, let's pick up on that when we come back. My guest today is Judge Vince Chu, and we'll be back with him in a moment. This is Afternoons with Mike here on The Shepherd. We are back in the studio with Judge Vince Chu, and he is a family court judge about ready to take on a new assignment as he will be going to civil law, a judge in civil law. My first ever interview with a judge, and I, you know, knowing how to prep for this was a little bit different, and obviously going through, there are some things. It is such a remarkable responsibility that I would believe that any judge has. You're there obviously needing to know not only the law, but also understanding the times in which we live and how to apply the law, which isn't like the law. It should be like an unbending thing, but we're seeing in this day and age where there's a lot of talk about law, where it is being at least perceived differently in the news media. And a lot of things that have happened are people are questioning it. So this is a big deal. The law is a big deal. The rule of law, and somebody like yourself that went to Ohio State on a full ride, thank God for that blessing. You've been able to apply yourself and go through all of that rigor. You must have read so much that your eyes probably were fatigued during those years. I can't imagine.
Well, it's a lot of reading. I'll be perfectly honest. My wife, who I met in law school, our very first, really the first day, kind of taught me, you know, how to really study. I mean, I was someone who always, I think, tested pretty well, and mm-hmm. I would before that. And
you didn't have to work as hard as some people,
right? But law school is a different game,
and yeah,
it was a growing experience that helped prepare me for, you know, what I do now.
Well, I'm grateful for all of what you've done to get yourself to the point where you could serve. And I really appreciated in segment one, you were talking about the fact that you didn't look that wonderful blessing of a full ride in the eye. You saw that as a way and as a call, maybe even, to give back and to serve, to become a public servant. Do you see the same emphasis, broadly speaking, in America about that idea of being a servant in a role such as yourself? It seems to me that that's something that was like maybe you're an old soul, so to speak. You're a generation older than what you are.
You know, I don't know. I guess I can't speak for everybody else. I mean, I know there's the perception that sometimes people who want to work hard and, you know, go and make money, and, you know, there's this perception about, you know, government service and that it's somehow, you know, you know they don't work as hard, or they don't. Mm-hmm. I mean, all I can say is that in my experience, it's not true. I mean, I've been around, you know, people who have, I mean, they're working 60-hour weeks, and they're people who have, especially with the Department of Justice, with the U.S. Attorney's Office, you're talking about people who graduated from the top law schools in the country. You're talking, they're Harvard, Yale, and mm-hmm. Stanford, all on the walls of their offices. And they're working 60 hours a week for probably a third of what they would make out in the private sector. So, I mean, I think it's very much alive. I think if it's, you have to approach it like, you know, I'm going to work as hard as the people making three times as much as me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the only way that this works.
Mm-hmm. As a judge, now I know that you are based in Orange County and serve right here in the Central Florida area. Is this something that you see yourself doing for a long time, or do you have further aspirations in law beyond these years?
Well, first of all, I'm in the Ninth Circuit, so we cover Orange and Osceola. So mm-hmm. I'm a judge for
both.
For both. It just depends on which division I'm assigned to. You know, as far as aspirations, I mean, I don't know that. The way I look at it is that my parents came here with nothing. I'm already playing with house money, so to speak. So for me to already be in the position I'm in, I guess I can only look at what I'm doing.
Oh, it's a wonderful thing.
And, but I, you know, I understand that I'm young, and I don't know. I don't know what 20 years from now, mm-hmm. 10 years from now holds. I will say I've never taken a job with the intent that I'm going to go on to the next job.
Mm-hmm.
And that may not be great career advice for other people, but for me, that's always been sort of my mantra, is that, you know, I take the job that I want, and I have to be willing to work this job for as long as I'm going to work it. I don't view things as stepping stones. So I certainly don't view this job as a stepping stone.
It's a great attitude, man. I really appreciate it. If you're just tuning in, this is Judge Vince Chu with me today on the program. You mentioned your wife and her impact on your study. Alicia is her name, and you met her there at Ohio State. What was she doing in her study pattern that was different than what you did, other than maybe, I know you said that it came easy for you, testing was always something that came pretty easy. Was she a harder worker at it, or what was it?
Oh, I mean, my wife is a tremendously hard worker. She's a brilliant attorney, very successful. And, you know, there's a system you learn in law school, which is, you know, you go through the cases, you identify the issue, you identify the rule, the application to this particular case, and then the conclusion that you can draw from the from that case, and then you know you make outlines and you go over it, and I mean there's a whole process that you know that goes into play that's more than just reading the material.
Right. Now I think most everybody who watches television, they've got an image. It's probably not a realistic one, an image of what of the life of an attorney is like, much less the life of a judge. But you've talked about this system of reading, and you know we all see those Olin Mills background of law books on the bookshelf, and there's just like one volume after another, and every one of them has got 1,000 pages, it seems, in it. You know, when you are studying a case, What would be an example of the amount of hours you have to put in terms of researching that case?
Well, I think it depends on the case. And number one, I will say that a lot of times most of those books are just for show now, because all of this information is at your fingertips.
With the internet.
On the internet. You know, okay.
Makes me feel better.
Right. They have case law search engines, you know, that lawyers subscribe to. You do it all on there, and you can navigate that much quicker than you can pull go and pull books and find them.
And as you're making notes, you can copy and paste as well, and that's really great.
Right. I mean, it depends. So when I was a trial attorney with the Department of Justice, it was exciting, and I tried over 40 cases in federal court, which is sort of this, you know, very, you know, high level, intense atmosphere. But even then, most of the work is happening in your office, plowing through the papers. It's, you know, trying a case is 90% drudgery. And when it comes to time to be in court, you know, if you've done all that drudgery, the exciting stuff kind of works itself out.
Yeah.
And I think as a judge, it's kind of like that, in the sense that I, you know, it's different in, you know, as an AUSA, I might handle 50 cases a year. As a judge, I'm handling, you know, 2,500 cases at a time.
Mm-hmm.
So
2,500 cases at a time.
Yes.
Oh my goodness.
So you're relying on the attorneys to take you there. You're reading their briefs. And then I'll do my own research. Ultimately, I've got three kids. So where that happens is after the kids go to bed, you know, before I go to bed, you know, I'll look through everything and, you know, double check the, the research and, get ready for, the week ahead.
Now, along with that, you've managed somehow to learn to play guitar and to be very good at it. And you are a worship leader. We've already heard that, about 15 years experience in leading worship. How did that come to you?
Well, I picked up the guitar in college because I thought it would impress. I thought it would impress.
Okay, now we're getting down to the end. There you go.
So, I was also a wedding singer for one summer in college.
Is that right?
Just as a side gig, but then I realized that as you know, I would get involved in church, and you know, this was one way that I could serve. This is one way that I can, I can contribute. That is in my wheelhouse. Because look, at the time I had no money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wasn't a you know, I really wasn't a natural evangelist. Although, you know, I learned to do a little bit of that, but the leading worship just, it came naturally to me. And, I found that I personally could feel the Holy Spirit the most, you know, in that way.
That's wonderful. Well, Vince is going to sing something for us here today. So we're going to have him grab the guitar that's hanging normally on my wall in my office, and he's going to offer a song and give that to us today as unto the Lord. So this is Judge Vince Chu. This is a first, all right. The first time I've had the singing judge on my program. That was Judge Vince Chu, and he is from Orange and Osceola County, the Ninth Circuit. And wow, what a wonderful privilege to have him come and be here in our studio today. Judge, that was beautiful. And did you ever have singing lessons or guitar lessons?
Not really. I think I tried to do it once or twice, but it never really stuck.
You know, when you think back to the worship, when you were a young man, you would not have, it was, you know, all of this has changed so much. And you mentioned going to that one camp when you really came to know and kind of experience this kind of an experience. It is an experience. It's an experience in and of itself to go someplace and to hear live worship where people are singing. And I know in that time they were a lot of people leading with guitars or keyboards or whatever. And it's just a lot different than the high church background that a lot of people had. And that was their only experience. When you look back at your first remembrances of hearing a kind of contemporary Christian worship, what hit your mind?
Well, so for me, I didn't come from that background. So it's you know, it just was what it was. And mm-hmm. it's what I was used to. I mean, I think that what I found, and I found this, I think, most pronounced way in South Africa when I was on that missions trip, was to see the gospel unvarnished, unattached to sort of culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of times Christianity comes in this whole package with all this cultural baggage. Whereas the gospel itself, oftentimes is quite universal. Well, I mean, it is universal. And I think the hard part and the challenge of that sometimes is to separate what is cultural, what is, you know, American Christian culture from what is scriptural gospel.
Mm-hmm.
And I think music is the same way. It's that, you know, music can you know, the message of God can come with drums, it can come with organs, and it's not any different. And there's nothing in scripture that really tells you that it has to be a certain way. It's just, a lot of times it's what we're used to.
Yeah. A friend of mine once said, if God liked a form of music, if we knew that somehow, what would it be? And one other person that I know said it would be anything but opera, which I disagree with, but I get it. I understand that there are personal preferences out there, but the song you did right there, obviously made very popular by Chris Tomlin, it is a real gift to the church, is it not? That we can have these kinds of worship so simple and so so heart-touching.
It is. And I think sometimes the, you know, I've led worship a lot of years, and sometimes the best times of worship are when your equipment breaks down.
Uh-huh.
When the, you know, for a lot of years I was doing a mobile church. So sometimes the truck breaks down, you can't get all your equipment, you know, in to unload. And a lot of times the most amazing times of worship are the simplest ones.
I agree completely. And we had a Sunday one time years ago up in Gainesville when I was there at Abundant Grace, where we had a major power outage. And it happened right on a Sunday, right in the beginning of our worship time. I mean, it was gone. So the emergency lights, the backup lights all came on. And we had a couple of guitar players that were there that day. It just so happened we had a couple of acoustic players, I being one of them. And we just kind of gathered down on the floor, had everybody move in, and we just did acoustic worship. And it was wonderful. It was wonderful. Many people said, ah, this is one of my favorite times in recent memory. It happens. Vince Chu is my guest today. He's a judge, and we're going to be back with him for one more segment. Don't go away. You're in tune to Afternoons with Mike right here on The Shepherd. So much fun today with Judge Vince Chu, and he is about to take on a new responsibility as being a civil court judge. He's been serving as a family court judicial officer for some time now, for about 2 years, and he was appointed by Governor DeSantis and will soon be stepping in, I guess what, the beginning of the year, right?
Yes.
So your duties will change, but your office will, or your courtroom will change slightly from what you've been doing.
Right. We'll be handling all kinds of civil disputes over $30,000.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, this is the first time that I've ever had an opportunity to sit with a judge like this and interview him. One of the things that has been on the hearts and minds in recent years, and you just hardly can't tune in even to a passion conference, but what they're talking about, some of the issues that has to do with sex trafficking, the current type of slavery that's going on in America, child exploitation. And this has been something that you've dealt with in family law as well, right?
Not so much in family law, but when I was with the Department of Justice, I mean, that was a priority of the department, was to address that. I mean, those are challenging cases. You know, a lot of times it's international in scope, mm-hmm. which is very challenging for law enforcement to deal with. Now, child exploitation was something that in general, you know, is something that the department, you know, definitely placed a priority on, and I worked some cases as to that. Now, the cases I worked tended to be hands-on offenders, people who were, you know, abusing children and recording it, making movies and things like that. It was
unthinkable.
Terrible.
Yeah.
And what we were able to catch is when I was with the department was really probably just the tip of the iceberg.
Mm. When you think back to those experiences and where people are today, from a standpoint of awareness, what do you think people really do need to be aware of, parents and young people alike?
Well, I think people need to be careful of who their children are around. The statistics are true that almost all of sexual abuse is the vast majority of it is perpetrated by people that they know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the one thing is to believe our children. I've known personally people, you know, close to me who have been victims, and it's the sort of thing that they carry with them for the rest of their
absolutely.
Lives.
Yeah. It's such an impact. And, it's like these images and these experiences that they go through, it's burned in their brains and they just can't get away from it. And it's heartbreaking, really, to see how many and how prevalent it actually is in Florida.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't know that Florida is any different than anywhere else, but, like I said, it's widespread And, you know, I think if we believe that that's not happening in churches, I think we are naive. Sometimes as Christians, we probably do need to think long and hard about whether the assumptions we're making about people are true.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if this would be something that you can even address, but this whole thing about being innocent until proven guilty, do you feel that by and large, our courts in America today are still abiding by that?
I think so. I mean, it is in every, it's in the jury instructions that, look, I mean, you are, you know, the state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that, that someone has committed a crime.
Mm-hmm.
It is one of the bedrock principles, you know, of our court system. You know, it's something that when I was a prosecutor, it's what helped me sleep at night, you know, to know that I had this burden to carry and that this person wasn't going to go to prison unless I carried that burden. So, I mean, it's.
Now you say that helped you sleep. That seems like that maybe somebody that's hearing this would think, holy cow, that would keep me up at night, but it helped you. You found peace in that.
Right. Because look, I mean, anybody who enjoys sending people to prison probably shouldn't be doing, you know, what they're doing. I mean, it should be a joyless task. And when I was a prosecutor, I mean, it was very much that, I never took joy, you know, in sending someone to prison per se. I mean, I found it rewarding to do my job and to enforce the rule of law. And like I said, I think it gave me comfort to know that I had this such a hot, heavy burden to carry in order to do that. You know, that in order for me to prove a case that would, you know, and when we were, you know, as a federal prosecutor, you're talking people going to prison for decades. To know that, you know, that a jury of 12 people unanimously found beyond a reasonable doubt, you know, and that they, you know, they held me to the burden that I had, you know, I had to carry in order before they said, yes, this person did it. You know, and they which, you know, subjected them to, you know, these harsh penalties.
Well, I appreciate a man who has conscience, who has really convictions. And not only that, but the obvious compassion. That's something that may not be talked about a whole lot in this day and age about those in the law enforcement business or in the judicial side of it. But to have compassion like you do, like you said, to not take joy in a really weird way in seeing a sentence that's going to be life-changing for people is a really big deal.
Yeah, I mean, and this is where I think my faith intersects with being a judge, because, you know, my job is to apply the laws of our earthly rulers. You know, I'm not here to apply biblical principles or biblical law, and frankly, it's not my job to even decide whether I like the laws or not. But as a Christian, what I can do is that I can treat everyone that's in front of me as someone who bears, we call it the Imago Dei, the image
of God. Yeah.
You know, so whether the person in front of me is wearing handcuffs or wearing a badge, or whether they're wearing rags or they're wearing a designer suit, that each of those people bear the image of God. And it's my job to enforce and apply the law, you know, in an impartial way, but it's also my calling to show them the love of Christ.
It's beautiful. Now, speaking of the love of Christ, we've already heard about how you came to know the Lord, and now as an adult, as a person living with your own children, you're also rooted and really greatly involved in a local church in this area too. Tell us about that.
I go to a church called H2O. For a long time we met at the building that's now the Ace Cafe over by the Lynx bus station. And then we were meeting in the the Abbey mm-hmm. over by Lake Eola for a little while. And we actually were just gifted a church building.
Wow.
On South Street. It was actually, that's an interesting story too. You know, it's mostly a younger church. You know, that's really kind of trying to reach people who are unchurched, de-churched. You know, one day a man in his 60s walks in and, starts coming to our church, finds Jesus, becomes a Christian, and he happens to be a commercial real estate developer, and brings his partner who was an atheist, and he becomes a Christian.
Oh my goodness!
And they purchased this property which had a church on it that was empty. They developed the property around it and gave the church to the building to our church.
Isn't that something? And it's on, you said, South Street?
Yes.
So that would be in the downtown area.
Yes. And that's the beauty of it. And that's the dream, mm-hmm. For this church is that, because of where we're located, and we're located on South Street, right next, right next to, the Milk District or in the Milk District. And the hope is that, we can build something that's maybe a little different than what we see, that, we can build a church where, people of different, economic backgrounds and different racial backgrounds can all come together, and worship together, break bread together, and be in a community together. So that's the hope and that's the dream there.
What do you see coming in 2022?
I don't have the faintest idea.
That's a great answer. I don't either. So we'll all just have to wait and see, huh?
Yeah. I think 2020 was a rough year. 2021 was.
Yeah. Do you think it was what we expected? 2021? We know that 20 was a big surprise.
I don't know. I think everybody expects something different. So I don't know. I can tell you obviously that for me, 2021 was an up and down year. And mm-hmm. I think for a lot of people, it was as well. I think we can all hope that, that the next year is, brings better things.
Yes. Well, it is certainly one that is still being affected by this pandemic. And although it is not as, fortunately, not as severe as what the first round of this disease was. And thankful that even though there are a lot of cases happening right now, they all seem to be a lot lighter and less lengthy in terms of enduring them. So that's a good thing, too. That's great. Your work will begin as a civil judge coming up. Do you have any thoughts about this? Is this something that you've been looking forward to? Or is this something now that it's here, you're going like, well, this is a new adventure.
Well, yeah, it's definitely something I'm looking forward to. I haven't had the opportunity to really practice in civil law. And, for me, it's kind of a Western frontier, mm-hmm. There's a sort of Byzantine system for how people get rotated into different divisions. But this was at the top of my list, so I'm excited. I wanted it I'm eager to get started.
Well, it's been great to have you here with us today. Judge Vince Chu has been my guest today. If you'd like to find out more information, go to www.keepjudgechu.com. That's spelled C-H-I-U. This is really an exciting thing to be able to pray, to ask our listeners to pray, not just for you, although I'm sure you'd welcome all the prayer that you can get, but for our entire government in Florida. These are times, are they not, that people are looking to Florida right now as being a real leader in the country in a number of different ways, a number of different directions. But those that, like yourself, that are trying to keep things on the straight and narrow need prayer.
Yeah, I think as much as made of politics, I think at core most people in government are, trying to make you know, the best decisions that they can with imperfect information, with limited resources, and obviously with competing interests. And as the court system, we're trying to do the same thing.
Well, I appreciate your being here, your sharing your music and your heart and your love for the Lord with us. Thank you for that, and we hope that you have a happy new year.
Well, thank you too. Thanks for having me, and I'm up for election in August. So would love your support and your vote. In the August election.
Well, our listeners will remember the singing judge. So that's good. That's great. And friends, to you on this New Year's Eve, a very happy New Year to you, and we'll catch you in the next time on Afternoons with Mike.